Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to our second episode of The Rest is History in our Avengers Assemble-esque crossover with Hardcore History's Dan Carlin. Now, if you haven't listened to the first episode already, just listen to the first episode. You will remember that Tom Holland and I set out to ask Dan Carlin the biggest questions in all history. Tom's were ridiculous and footling multiple choice questions. Mine were genuinely big and serious questions. And anyway, without further ado, let's get on with it, or we'll be approaching the length of one of Dan's infamous 27-hour podcasts. So, Tom, the next question for Dan, please.
What would you choose to be? A French nobleman born in 1330, a Lakota chieftain born in 1865, a member of the British upper classes born in 1894?
Is this like a trick question? Because the only one of the, and it's only my ignorance that makes me want to pick the French example, because I'm trying to think what happened after 1330 that's as bad as what happens to the Lakota after the 1800s, and what happens.
Black Death.
Yes. Okay. Of course, it's the Black Death. I wasn't thinking continent wide. Well, I was thinking
and the Hundred Years War.
I was thinking the Hundred Years War.
But the
of.
Black Death is really what's.
Goodness gracious. What was the first option again?
French nobleman born in 1330.
Oh, what was the second option?
Lakota chieftain born in 1865. A member of the British upper classes born in 1894.
Oh, man. Those all suck, don't they?
That was the point.
I'm going to say the British upper classes.
That's the right answer, isn't it?
Is it? I think it's got to be.
Because, I mean, you're thinking of the First World War, but lots of people don't fight in the First World War.
Okay, a male.
There's lots of planners. There's lots of people behind the scenes.
Yeah, you guys are looking at this from too highfalutin. It's dentistry. This has to be decided based on the level of dentistry.
It's all bad.
It's not 14th century bad.
I mean, Tom, surely someone like Bertie Wooster was born in 1894 or thereabouts.
But didn't George Orwell famously say that the real Bertie Wooster died in
in
1915?
Yeah, I think you could have had a very different life where you could still have gone to Eton and then Oxford or Cambridge, but then you could have spent the war throwing bread rolls at people in the Drones Club and doing some sort of.
Well, you could be invalided out and become a poet, I suppose.
Well, you could be J.R.R. Tolkien. Couldn't you? Yeah, you could be writing fantasy novels about dragons.
Could have been Winston Churchill.
Yeah, absolutely, right. You could be. But Tolkien, I mean, he lost, what was it, kind of three of, you know, there was a band of four friends and three of them died.
That's better. That's a hell of a lot better than the Black Death.
Yeah, but you could be Chaucer. Having your civilization wiped out with a Lakota.
Yeah, you could be Chaucer. I mean, Chaucer lived through that.
When was Chaucer born?
About the same time.
He's not French, though, is he?
No. but lots of French people survived the Black Death. I think you're likelier to be killed in the trenches if you remember. British officer.
Is your choice a French nobleman?
I think it is, yeah.
It's interesting that nobody chooses the Lakota option.
that's just unspeakably awful.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Because so there you have your entire way of life destroyed as well.
Yeah, and if you survive, it still sucks. So, I mean, that's the difference.
Yeah.
So when you were about 30, is it you're doing the ghost dance? Is that about right? Is that 1890s?
1890s, yeah.
So you've got the ghost dance to look forward to, as it were.
Yeah, but then you get the, then you get wounded knee right afterwards.
Right. Yeah. It's not good, is it?
It's bad.
It's not good. Yeah. Okay, that was actually quite an easy one.
I think
no, it's
so.
Not. I think being a French nobleman would be brilliant. No, especially if you were good at jousting.
You're going to get killed at Agincourt.
You are. You're going to be killed, Tom, when you're, well, I mean, look at these dates. You'll be killed when you're 85 at the Battle
of Yeah, but of you're likely to be killed in the Battle of the Somme than you are in, you know, a battle during the Hundred Years' War. Mm-hmm. If you had the choice of which, you know, would you rather fight in the First World War or the Hundred Years' War? Hundred Years' War every time.
Oh, God, I think that's
especially if you're a nobleman.
Hundred years, because
if you're a nobleman, you're like, you're going to get ransomed.
Yeah, I suppose
if you live, yeah.
If you're a member of the upper class, you know, you're a junior officer.
Dan, I don't know if you've noticed this, but Tom's questions come with an enormous number of caveats. So if you remember, there was that one about the siege where he would be a woman with children. This time, he would be a French nobleman. But,
yeah, but as a French nobleman, I'm going to be ransomed, whereas as a British officer, I'm going to be blown up.
Well, but let's understand, though, a lot of people survived the First World War. I mean,
I accept that.
Including Germans. I mean, Russians. I mean, and those people took abhorrent casualties. I mean, Hitler survived it.
Yeah, he did. Yeah,
that is true. All right. So you're both going for British member of the upper classes. I'm going for French nobleman. And none of us are going for Lakota chieftain.
No.
Okay. All right. So we have another one, Tom.
Yeah.
So we have a big question, a woolly question. Yeah. Dan, wouldn't we be happier if we stopped studying history?
Oh, that's an interesting line. I don't think so myself, but I have no other way to look at it. So I can't imagine what it would be like to go through life not knowing this stuff. I see your point. I see the point of the question. But I'm not sure that I get depressed by studying these terrible stories of the past. In fact, some of the emails I get about the most terrible shows we do is just the opposite of what you might expect, where people will say, gosh, I thought my life was so terrible until I studied about what it was like in the trenches of the First World War, and now I have a better perspective that my life isn't so terrible. I think that's how I look at it. Like I had mentioned the dentistry example to you guys earlier, I try to keep it real. Things like that make me appreciate my own time more and put it into a perspective and realize how fortunate I am. But yes, that only is reflected in the fact of how terrible the other times were. So I don't see it that way, but it depends maybe on one's personality type.
But also, doesn't it depend where you are? So for example,
if you're in Ukraine.
Right. Or if you're in Russia, or indeed if you're in Yugoslavia in the 1990s. I mean, there are an enormous number, I would argue, of civil wars, for example, or ethnic conflicts, where a sense of history is absolutely central to the stoking up of resentments, the sense of victimhood, the sense of fear that leads to hatred, that leads to violence. And if you take the history out, in other words, if people are no longer saying, well, let me tell you, great uncle so-and-so was butchered by the people next door and we'll never forget it. If you take that out, I mean, Northern Ireland might be a good example.
The Serbs with the Field of Blackbirds, right?
Right, the Battle of Kosovo. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, Vladimir Putin is a man who spent last summer writing a ridiculously long manifesto. Or
getting someone to write it for him.
Right, exactly. Fair enough, Tom. But you know what I mean. I mean, I don't doubt that Putin has a sense of history, of Russia's history, and it's a sense of grievance based on history. And if you took that out, of course, it's an implausible scenario because you never can take it out.
Well, but it reminds me of what you're saying is, wouldn't we all be happier if we didn't have any memories? Right. If all of a sudden we didn't remember any of the bad things that ever happened to us, we would go through. It's, you know, the Planet of the Apes comes to mind with the lobotomy,
or Brave New World, really. I mean, it's Brave New World, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
We're all just happy on drugs.
Yeah.
But I mean, in the United States, we're talking about this cold civil war. History does seem to be at the heart of what people are tearing themselves to pieces over in the US at the moment.
What that implies is that if we didn't have the history, that we would be all, lovey-dovey instead. And I, And there's two kinds of history. Maybe we could differentiate here. If I'm going to play Tom's role here and have a whole bunch of caveats in the question, but one might say long-term history versus short-term history. I mean, if people in the United States remember the last 10 years, that might be enough to cause 90% of the problems we have today. Without, you know, the United States does not have a long historical memory anyway, is the traditional knock on it compared to the old world, as we call it. So I don't know. I think that implies you need a reason to hate someone, and I'm not sure you do, although I was doing stories. I was a local news reporter when Yugoslavia broke up, and we used to do things called localizing the news, which is, you know, you'll go find some people who live in your area who are expats or something from that area, and while the big national network news is running actual footage of Sarajevo under siege, you're talking to people who used to live there and asking them questions. And they brought up just what you were mentioning, that these ethnic hatreds that have been such a long-term facet of the region, and as you all remember better than most, before the First World War, you had these terrible Balkan wars that had gone on. They had said that most of that had gone away. So imagine a fire that had died down to just the glowing coals. And then they had said that the bad economic times that struck was seized upon by demagogues who were able to then stoke those almost out fires in a way that just brought them back to life, right? In other words, taking this glorious history, repurposing it, and reminding people of how much they hated each other as a way to personally benefit or to create the conditions where Greater Serbia could emerge or what have you. So in that sense, maybe you have a point. It would have been better to not have that memory to stoke again.
Yeah. I once read a brilliant book, actually. The what put this in my mind was I read a book by a guy called, I don't know if you read this, Tom, by a guy called Jeremy Treglown, and it's about, called Franco's Crypt, and it's about the Spanish Civil War. And most of the books that are written in English about the Spanish Civil War, sort of commentaries on it, talk about the unfinished business, about this sort of this sense that there was a culture of forgetting, and there are still graves where, and you know, people are very keen to sort of dig up to find the mass graves and so on. And to sort of, and Spanish politics still involves an enormous amount of arguing about the Spanish Civil War. And in this book, he said, I think they should just let it go.
Yeah.
I think it creates too much bad blood. It intensifies political conflict and partisanship. It creates a sense of us and them. And actually, sometimes there really is an argument, unjust as it may seem. And I do think it just seems unjust, but there may be an argument to just say, absolutely forget about it. Let it go.
Well, that was, I mean, it wasn't quite what Mandela said. He said, you know, forgiveness can become a kind of amnesia.
Yeah.
Up to a point.
But look at how weird this can get if we take it to the really big versions, right? It would be like saying, if we could just forget the Holocaust, it would be, you know, it'd be such a weight off society's shoulders or blah, blah, blah. I mean, but that almost sounds offensive, but it's a unique situation. But it's not a unique situation, right? Because everybody, I mean, the Field of Blackbirds is its own kind of Holocaust, yeah, isn't it? Masada's still remembered. The Armenians and the Turks are still remembered. I mean, at a certain point, to suggest that you just get over it is offensive to those people because you're asking them to forget their history. I mean, listen, the point is well taken. The point is well taken. I mean, if we could selectively erase people's memories so that the hatreds that are ancient were gone, would be great, except that a lot of those hatreds exist for certain reasons.
I mean, also, there's a particular particular situation, say, in the United States or in Britain or in France, which are countries that traditionally have been very self-confident about their history. They have felt that, you know, British history or French history or American history is a cause of pride. It fosters a sense of patriotism. And a lot of the culture wars seem to me to be about whether that is actually the case or not, whether there is more in American or British or French history to be ashamed of than to be proud of. And I get the sense that people who are made happy by reflecting on their country's history, that is one of the things that makes them most angry, is when that sense of happiness is kind of threatened. Do you think?
Well, I think it's one of those things, and you, it's a point I have not considered enough, perhaps, when you bring it up, because I'm thinking about the countries maybe that have histories that are a lot less laudable, right? In other words, would you be if you are a Chinese person today? Would you be happy recounting Chinese history in the last couple of hundred years, or would you be embarrassed?
No.
Right?
But you'd be proud, I think. Thinking of the antiquity of Chinese civilization,
there's no question.
And the great role that it's played in bringing.
No question.
But I don't think you'd be ashamed, Tom, or embarrassed. I think you would, if you're a country that has, my sense is that a country that has, as it were, been on the receiving end in the last, let's say, 500 years, the way you tell that, they tell that story tends to be our resilience under terrible pressure from these ghastly bullies. I mean, that's how Chinese. That's the story of Chinese history, right? It's not we were a complete basket case and everybody invaded us. It's more, you know, we stood up over time to Western imperialism. We were resilient.
Yes. So people there is always definitely pride in China.
I would say countries almost always try to find pride in their history.
Well, except that. I mean, I'm thinking the case of the United States, that traditionally the story of the revolution and the Founding Fathers has been a cause of pride, and the beginnings of America is identified with the Revolutionary War. But recently, of course, it's been identified with the bringing of the first slaves to America in the early 17th century. And that has generated a kind of counter-narrative, which asks Americans essentially to stop being quite so happy about their history. And the same here in Britain, where most Britons were, Churchill is a hero. He saved Britain, he saved the world. But now there's a kind of counter-narrative that emphasizes, you know, he was a racist, he did this, he did that.
But Tom, I mean, maybe Dan can correct me if I'm wrong, but I would say those arguments that you're talking about are arguments within small, highly educated, largely university and media-based minorities. And I'm not sure how much they've percolated to the
I think they do.
Public.
I think, but I think that that's what, I mean, I remember some, I can't remember where it was, but somebody said, woke tosh, is
is this me? Did I say this?
No, it wasn't you. Woke tosh is the stuff that people get taught about history in schools that you weren't taught in your school. That sense that people, academics in universities, are chipping away at George Washington or Winston Churchill, and how dare they?
Yeah. What do you think, Dan?
I think that it's the difference between, you know, and I talk about it all the time, and you guys know this absolutely perfectly. It's the difference between how a historical figure looks to us centuries or decades later versus what they looked like at the time, how they get squashed into a two-dimensional figure that's more of a representation of something, right? Someone you put a statue up because they serve a purpose. You know, in your society at the time, you put the statue up, right, as an example or something to look forward to or to emulate. Whereas when you add water to that two-dimensional figure and they three-dimensionalize again and you see them with all their warts, I think there's two things in play. One, a sense of almost betrayal. Right? How can our hero be a racist, for example? But also this sort of a feel that there's more than one side to history. So, for example, if I was going to teach a course on Winston Churchill, I would love to have every, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you bring in somebody who's an enormous fan of Churchill, and Tuesday, Thursday, you bring in somebody who brings up all the bad points, and you three-dimensionalize the person, and that, I think when you do that, you begin to disabuse people of the notion that if somebody has warts, one should not revere them anymore. It's like I was talking to somebody the other day because Thomas Jefferson came up in the recent show that I had, and I was trying to point out that if Thomas Jefferson was a horrible person for owning slaves, the fact that he pushed forward these ideas of freedom and liberty actually helped slave societies all over the world who seized upon those ideas and used them for their own justification. And what I had said was, I don't mean that he was, I'm not trying to say this, but let's imagine a guy who invents one of the great vaccines that has saved millions of lives in world history was a terrible person. Well, one still celebrates the achievement. One doesn't have to love the person. And so I feel like a lot of the reason we get so angry at these historical figures is there's this sense that they have either let us down, right? Or this sense that we're celebrating somebody who's not this good person, but there are definitely good things you can tease out. It's a pendulum, isn't it? Where the pendulum tends to overcorrect before it finds its new baseline, which, look, should we understand that Churchill had views that we would consider to be racist today? We absolutely should, but that should be presented in the context that if only people in the who born in the 1880s, 1890s, if the only people we can celebrate are the ones who weren't racist by today's standards, who grew up in that place and that time, it's going to be a remarkably small group of people, and they may have no other reason to laud them except for that.
But also, I suppose, isn't there? I mean, I agree with everything you were saying, Dan, but I would argue that we're more, as a society, maybe we are less tolerant of warts than we might have been 50 or 100 years ago. In other words,
well,
I don't think
our sense of what warts are has changed.
I was just going to say that, Tom, exactly.
But I don't think there was ever a time when people, if you take Churchill, let's say, or indeed the American founding fathers, I mean, even when the statues were put up, I don't think there was ever a time when people genuinely thought these are pristine, saintly, utterly unimpeachable figures. I mean, the Churchill is the obvious example. Everybody knew about the various flaws that Churchill had, the mistakes, the outrageous public statements, all those kinds of things. But they sort of thought, but they had a mature view of what it was to be human. In other words, that any well-known public figure was bound by definition to have said and done things that people might find objectionable. I wonder whether the current climate is more hostile to that sort of capacious view of human nature, and that we are less tolerant of failings than our predecessors might have been.
Well, but you bring up a good point about Churchill, which is, here's a guy who lived long enough to be born in a period where his views were not controversial and lived through when those views had changed, right? So here's a man who, by the time he dies, is reviled by a whole segment of the British governing class, right? And as you said, even during his prime, some of them. I think that's a little bit different than the way, when I'm growing up in the 1970s, we still viewed George Washington, and I don't remember hearing a bad thing about the guy ever, right? I mean, it was the put up statues to your founding fathers and create a myth around them. We were still talking about George Washington cannot tell a lie, chopping down the cherry tree stuff, and this is in the 1970s. So I think it's on a figure-by-figure basis, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. I think it's time to move on to another hugely important question.
Tom, before you do that, let us take a quick break. We'll see you in a second. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp.
Bottling everything up is never a good idea. It can have terrible consequences. For instance, look at all the conflicts throughout history. I wonder how many of them could have been solved if they just talked things out.
And Tom, I have a confession for our listeners. As you know, I've been really struggling with anxiety about the massive series that we've got coming on The Rest Is History, all the prep we have to do for that series on the French Revolution, the First World War. I mean, it's all mounting up, isn't it? And when we talked it out, I felt so much better now that I got all those crippling anxieties and insecurities off my chest.
If you want to talk, you can always talk to me. But if not, then I highly recommend therapy. It can help you learn positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. Therapy isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. It empowers you, Dominic, to be the best version of yourself.
If you want to give therapy a try, why not check out BetterHelp? It's entirely online, it's convenient and flexible, and it's really easy to get started. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and they'll match you with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp.
Visit betterhelp.com/restishistory today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, help.com/restishistory.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Napoleon Grills. Just like a great meal, Napoleon Grills are made with premium ingredients. An ignition system powered by jet engine technology, gas burners that provide even heat, safety glow lights that let you know when the gas is on, an infrared sizzle zone for perfectly seared steaks. Plus, they're built to last with industry-leading warranties. Napoleon Grills, innovation built better. Learn more at napoleon.com.
Hello and welcome back to The Rest is History. Tom, I'm sorry, I know I rudely interrupted you there to ensure that we satisfy our loyal commercial partners with one of our greatly loved ad breaks. So listen, let's fire away with question number 6. Off you go, Tom.
Dan, you are the ruler of a Eurasian state in AD 1000. So anywhere in Eurasia. Which one of the following inventions would you choose to have? And you can only have one. Gunpowder, the printing press, or the germ theory of disease?
Wow. Well, as a ruler, none of those sound that good to me other than gunpowder, because that's the only one I think I can use for me, right? Because if I'm not necessarily going to care about any, I mean, you know, the printing press, to me, that's a negative waiting to happen.
You're right. you're mad. As a ruler, you're demented.
Yeah, you don't want anything about that. No, don't be translating text that my average people can read. That's an easy one. And the gunpowder thing, I mean, as you guys all know, I mean, gunpowder was in existence for a long time before anybody found a way to usefully use it in warfare. So I'm not sure that as the Eurasian ruler in 1000 that I'm going to manage to figure out anything other than some colorful fireworks for a while with that stuff. The germ. So I'm going to default to the germ theory of history because the other two to me don't sound like what I as a ruler would want. And maybe if only because a germ theory of history helps me protect me and mine and maybe gives me some clues as to how maybe I could weaponize it against my enemies.
And you might be remembered as Dan the Good.
If I had anything to say about it with my printing press, that is how I would
remember. The germ theory. I mean, I'm thinking about rulers in the year 1000. So Canute. Or yes. Ethelred the Unready.
Yeah.
What are they going to do with the germ theory?
Infect the Mercians, you know?
well, actually, the setting up of hospitals is caring for the sick is very important.
I don't see Canute doing that, Tom.
Yeah, of course he did.
Did he?
He went on pilgrimage to Rome.
That was for his own purposes. That made him good.
That's a power move right there.
Exactly. That's nothing to do with being kind to people who've got smallpox.
I think you're being unduly cynical. But, I mean... Dominic, what would you choose?
Well, I completely agree. When you read out the question, I initially thought the printing press, but of course, when you read out the question, and I thought ruler of a Eurasian state. If you're a ruler of a Eurasian state and you've only got one lifetime, as it were, you're mad to choose the printing press. If you're playing a computer game in which you're controlling a state for 1,000 years or something, obviously you do choose the printing press.
Right, right.
But no, I choose probably... I just don't see what they're going to do with the germ theory.
Or gunpowder, though. That's the problem.
Well, the fireworks. I like the thought of the fireworks.
Okay.
Yeah, you're Chinese emperor.
Yeah.
But what did they do with it?
But you see, imagine you're a caliph in Baghdad and you have the printing press.
But you don't. Would you control it, though? The nature of a printing press is... is there ever an instance in history of a state that got the printing press and then the regime...
And then it go horribly wrong.
Yeah, and then the regime had a monopoly, which it kept.
It's a destabilizing force, isn't it, the printing press?
Right.
Okay, but I think this is revealing quite a lot about the approach that you would bring to ruling a Eurasian state. Because you might say that as a ruler, your concern is with the prosperity and health and happiness of your people.
As long as mine's included in that, and there may be a divergence.
Well, I'll tell you, Tom, about my theory of history. So my son at school was asked the other day, because everybody knows that his dad does history podcasts with the great Tom Holland, and they said, "Does he ever tell you anything about the lessons from history?" And he said, in front of the whole class, he said, "Yes, your neighbors will probably try to kill and eat you, so you should eat them first."
So true. That is the lesson of history.
There's a t-shirt in there somewhere.
You see, I would go for the printing press because I would want to bring education to my people and make them happier and wiser.
I don't believe
they would overthrow you.
Well, that's as may be. But I would die knowing that I'd done good.
All right. So I think we're all agreed. Tom is wrong.
Tom the wise.
Tom, you're just you're not thinking like a ruler from the one. I mean, those people. I mean, ruler, right? Not average citizen. Well, not cleric.
Alfred the Great, great sponsor of literacy.
Okay, he would have had a printing press. I agree.
Yeah,
with you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he's a great king. So,
okay,
that's who I'm going with.
let's get back to 20th century again. So, Dan, do you think the West could have lost the Cold War?
Yes, I think they could have lost the Cold War.
Could I just ask, what does losing the Cold War mean?
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? What would that look like?
That's a very good question. I think I think that losing the Cold War as we had defined it, and all of us are old enough to remember how that game was played, right, would have been for lots of the world to have gone communist, right? That was the way, I mean, with the domino theory, I mean, this was how you measured how you were either winning or losing at that time. And that's why so many of these proxy wars were fought, or certainly why what the excuse was openly, right? So had there been a reality to the domino theory, which I don't think there was, in my own opinion, but let's imagine that there had been. And maybe to piggyback off of what Dominic was saying, is that maybe winning simply losing means not winning. Right. I mean, simply not having the Soviet Union fall, that may be victory enough, depending on how you're viewing it. But I do think to say that the West couldn't have lost the Cold War is to insinuate that no mistake made by any major leader in the West would have been consequential enough to have cost them the game. In other words, you're saying that every American president essentially could have just been on autopilot or make terrible decisions, and yet the end result would be we'd win the Cold War anyway. And I just don't buy that.
Ooh, I mean, there are two ways, aren't there, really? So there's a nuclear war in which nobody wins. So that, I guess, was always a risk. But isn't the stake in the Cold War basically who controls Europe?
Yeah, it's certainly the beginning. The beginning is who controls
Europe. Well, you guys, wait a minute. Are we thinking about this in traditional geopolitical terms, or are we thinking about this in the ideological terms that colored that war? Because if you're thinking about this as though it were Alfred the Great's England and that's how we're grading things, well, then it's a different story. But I think the people at the time would have seen the ideological winning and losing to be the main issue, not the geopolitical, you know, how far has the Soviet Union expanded westward? You know, I mean, in that sense, then communism doesn't matter. Although I'm reminded of Gwen Dyer, the great Gwen Dyer's attitude that if you took the ideology out of it, that the Cold War would have been completely understandable to, you know, 16th century Spanish diplomats and whatever as a pure power game. But I think if you're the United States and you're talking about the kind of arguments we used to have amongst Republicans and Democrats and hawks and doves, it all would have been ideological based rather than some geopolitical question.
On the ideological front, Soviet communism collapsed, but the world's most dynamic state at the moment is at least nominally a communist country with the party in control.
Well, what if India had gone communist? I mean, what if? I mean, so you're talking about the Chinese version of this.
Right.
Well, what if somehow India had gone communist too, and you had an India-Chinese? I mean, fascinating things to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I think the West could have lost the Cold War.
Growing up in Britain in the 1980s, my understanding of the Cold War, who was going to win or lose, was would Britain end up communist?
Yeah, maybe that's a very...
You know, or kind of, you know, within the Soviet sphere.
I mean, as Dan says, there are two different ways of looking at it, aren't there? There's the way where you look at the maps that we grew up with in Britain, which were the division in Europe.
Yes, with kind of Warsaw Pact units and NATO units and blocks and things.
Is it plausible?
But I was over-influenced by General Sir John Hackett's The Third World War. Did you ever read that?
I read a lot of Hackett stuff. I didn't read that one.
Well, it was actually quite rather chilling because he wrote it in 1978. So it was before Iran went toto. And it tried to work out how a Warsaw Pact NATO war in Europe would pan out. And the Warsaw Pact starts to lose rather in the way that Putin perhaps is suffering reverses in Ukraine at the moment. And the Soviets choose to escalate it by nuking Birmingham in England.
Yeah, they do nuke Birmingham, don't they?
And so NATO then have to respond and they nuke Minsk. And it's on a kind of knife edge whether the whole world is now going to get nuked. And there is a coup in Moscow. And Hackett said this was the only way he could think of to stop nuclear Armageddon happening, which is a cheery thing to bear in mind, perhaps at the moment.
I mean, the question, I suppose the question that underpins this is, was communism doomed to fail? And I'm not convinced necessarily that it was. I mean, we did a series of podcasts about the Soviet Union in the 1980s and then Russia in the 1990s. And the sort of the contingency, the great contingency, is the arrival of Gorbachev. If you take Gorbachev out of the equation, it's not obvious to me that the USSR dissolves in 1991. Communism, well, one-party state, I would say could have, well, I mean, there's no reason why it couldn't have continued indefinitely if it's done so in China. with
there's a wonderful theory, though. I mean, and let me throw this out there, because I remember hearing it from a military guy first, and I've since seen it in print in a number of different places. And it has to do, you know, in the United States, we have a what's the word here? We have a sort of a totem, for lack of a, that's taken control about how and why the Soviet Union fell. And it's the whole Reagan outspent them kind of thing. Mm. But that's the military guy that I spoke to. And like I said, I've since seen this in multiple places, had a much better point, which is that if you look at where military hardware development was going, and starting in the late 1970s, the systems were going to require heavier duty computer elements to it, that eventually was going to require the equivalence of communication and all sorts of things that were the antithesis of what the Soviet society could have handled. In other words, if you want the brand new, really good tanks and aircraft, you're going to have to allow your society to develop technologically to levels that can compete with the West, but you can't do that in a closed society. And the argument was that part of what Gorbachev was doing with this glasnost was not some peace and love wonderful thing. It was an attempt to open up the door enough so that you could continue to compete militarily with a West that was going to defeat you eventually with drones and satellites and all these things. I mean, can you imagine the Soviet Union, who was afraid and upset with one radio signal crossing the Iron Curtain with Radio Free Europe? Can you imagine them trying to deal with it with Twitter? I mean, the two things almost can't coexist. And you'd have to be like North Korea. And if you're like North Korea, can you really have the top sort of weaponry and communication technologies you need to compete with the West without the openness that those tools sort of commit you to? Does that
make
sense?
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because China undoubtedly has kind of picked up on the lesson that to compete with the West, you need to have be absolutely the cutting edge of tech. And seems to have done it very, very successfully, but has not gone for the kind of open society option.
Oh, but they're much more open than the old. I mean, imagine the Soviet Union in the 50s looks much more like North Korea does. And China, I mean, there are people who say China's got a sort of a communist patina on it now, but that it's not really what we would. I mean, what can you imagine what somebody like Stalin or Gorbachev or someone like Khrushchev would have said about modern day China and how well that fit into the Trotsky Leninist, you know, Bukharin paradigm. I mean, it doesn't even look like a communist country of the sort we grew up. It just looks like an authoritarian country.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I think that is a fair point, that it's not in any meaningful way a kind of Marxist Leninist country, is it? Or indeed a Maoist country.
It is quite a totalitarian, becoming a more, I mean, under Qi, it is becoming.
Yeah, it's an authoritarian society.
Becoming more authoritarian. I mean, in 30 years' time, people may be asking the same question about the contest between the United States and China, perhaps. Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, so what did we decide on this? We decided the West, well, Dan, you said the West could have lost.
Well, but if you say they couldn't have lost, then none of the decisions that were made matter.
Yeah. I suppose, well, for example, there's a scenario, I suppose, in which the United States walks away at the end of the 1940s or early 1950s, in a similar way to what happened after the First World War. I mean, it obviously didn't happen, and it didn't happen for very good structural, deep-seated reasons. But the United States could have walked away. There could have been no Marshall Plan. There could have been communism in Italy or France. And then you're in a very different kind of ballgame, aren't you?
I think so. I think especially, you know, I remember going to Italy in the late 70s, so let's say 77, and I remember seeing a red flag with a hammer and sickle flying from one of the main buildings. And I just remember as an American during that era just being shocked, because you didn't expect communism to have such a foothold in a place like Italy. But your point is well taken. And I mean, imagine it. Here's funny. Imagine it in the Scandinavian countries. I mean, yeah. You can't even get your mind around a communist Norway or a communist Sweden. But think about how different that would have been.
Well, I mean, actually, the example
kind of Finlandization.
I was about to say.
Yes, exactly. Finlandization, yeah.
A Finlandization of more of Europe, in which Sweden, Denmark, who knows, West Germany, Western border zone is.
Well, that seems to be Putin's. I mean, that's it seems to be his ideal.
He's not
for much of Eastern Europe, certainly, and I would guess Scandinavia.
Yeah, but
would
given
be
that
a kind of equivalent
Sweden
to Finlandization.
Just about to
I know.
Well,
he's miscalculated. Yeah. He's miscalculated. But I would have thought that was probably what he was hoping for to get from Ukraine, if he conquered Ukraine.
Well, that was his dream scenario, wasn't it? I think.
Well, let me ask you guys, because now I got you here. I'm going to turn the tables a little bit because I'm curious about your thoughts on this. But I mean, do you think he just, Putin in this sense, do you think he just miscalculated the attitudes that the former Soviet border states had in turn? I mean, we're reading a lot here, and I never trust this sort of material for, like you had said, we're going to have to wait 30 years to really find out, you know, all the ins and outs of what's going on right now. But the idea that he would be welcomed, that the Russians would be welcomed with flowers the way that they were saying the United States would have been welcomed in Iraq, is that rose-colored glasses, and is that something that's connected to his rose-colored view of the old Soviet past? I mean, to me, right there, that's a huge miscalculation, and it looks like his strategy and tactics were inordinately based on that view of the situation. What are your thoughts on that?
As you say, it's very hard for us to know right now.
Fog of war is terrible right now.
How the decision-making in the Kremlin works. But, I mean, I don't know. I think I'm not the first person to have said this by any means. I've read it elsewhere. When you produce propaganda, the first people you persuade are yourselves, the producers of the propaganda. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that he's come out with about, you know, the Ukraine government are all neo-Nazis, but also the sort of the more babble sort of stuff where he says, you know, Zelensky is a drug addict, they're all degenerates, all this kind of sort of stuff. I think he said that so often that he actually genuinely ended up believing it. And
I think also, Dominic, you that there was clearly a massive undercover war going on within Ukraine between rival security services. And my guess is that Putin thought that he had basically kind of gone through the Ukrainian military, the Ukrainian government, the Ukrainian civil service, like kind of woodworm.
Yeah,
and that all he had to do was give it a knock, and the whole structure would come
he
tumbling down. But it's evident that there was a kind of an incredibly effective Ukrainian campaign of combating that, and I think that U.S. and actually British intelligence as well probably seems to have played a very important role in kind of rolling up that campaign. And that is a campaign that also, of course, has been manifest in the Baltic states, where the Russian minorities, and, you know, in France, where he was funding Marine Le Pen, in Italy, where he has quite, I suspect that he maybe because he's a man in a hurry and he wanted to believe it, maybe because his deputies were telling him what he wanted to hear, maybe because they genuinely believed that they had turned Ukraine rotten. But for all those reasons, I think that he overestimated how easy it would be.
But I think there were lots of arguments, aren't there, that Russian nationalists are predisposed to think that Ukraine is rotten, that they have a very particular relationship with Ukraine, where they undervalue Ukrainian nationalism. They think it's an invention, a concoction created by Western powers. I mean, it's really interesting how that as soon as the invasion started to go badly, and all those clips from Russian talk shows that circulate on social media, you know, you've probably seen, certainly, Tom, there's one that in Britain that's been circulating where there was a Russian MP who's denouncing Britain, saying there's the double-headed, you probably won't have seen this, Dan, because it's something that matters to us, but probably not to anybody else, because it makes us seem very important. This Russian MP went on this show about 3 days ago, and he said, you know, there's a double-headed dragon that controls world affairs. And there's the United States and there's Britain. And as everybody knows, Britain is the more evil and conniving of the two
heads. The glow of patriotic pride that we've all been feeling.
But relevance, sweet relevance.
Yeah, sweet relevance.
But he sort of ends this by saying, you know, go back to your island, catch your chip and fish in your foggy marshes.
Eat your porridge. And pray for your moss-covered queen.
Yeah. But obviously, lots of people in Russian nationalist circles think that Britain, the United States in particular, NATO, have created a false national identity in Ukraine, and they merely needed to give that a push, and it would just disintegrate as the miserable kind of concoction that it was. And they completely underestimated the resilience of the Ukrainian ideal.
I think also, don't you, that there is there has been a lurking sense in Russia that the West is decadent, and that's why Putin's been so keen on kind of transgender toilets and things like that.
But he's not. He's keen on talking. He's not keen on them. I mean, he's talking.
No, he's keen on talking about them. And I think in that sense, Zelensky is a kind, you know, was the absolute embodiment of that kind of decadence.
An to actor Putin, yeah, to Putin.
Who, you know, who'd been on television playing a grand piano with his penis. I mean, this is absolute, you know, he must have looked at that and thought the whole country's going to fold.
Yeah. You know, you can't help but notice that that's a very similar attitude toward Hitler's idea when he invaded the Soviet Union, that he wasn't going to have to conquer it lock, stock and barrel, but that like a rotten house, all you had to do was kick the door down. Right. And that it would fall. And by the way, he, as a veteran of the First World War, that's not a terrible example of maybe what happened to the Tsarist regime in the First World War. But let me point out, and I'm going to get a lot of maybe Americans upset with me for noticing the similarities. But if you change the word Nazi that the Russians are using for Ukraine and substitute communism, which, of course, the Russians could not have easily have done, it doesn't sound too different than the sort of rationale that American hawks used to use to want to go into Central American countries. I mean, specifically, I'm thinking of Panama with Manuel Noriega, where we didn't just push the potential for a communism thing, but we even pushed the drug angle or all the things that you mentioned that he was looking at with Zelensky and that we've seen. I mean, they even brought up this news story about cocaine and Zelensky and all the. I mean, it's almost like there's a playbook of various things that you can. You know, not 19 things that you can cite and, you know, at least five of them to go to war. And they're all the same variations of things that we've seen forever. I mean, Machiavelli might have had the original 19 and you just I don't know if Mad Libs means anything to you guys, but you just sort of Mad Lib your way to a war a rationale and calling. I mean, the Russian minister, was it today or yesterday, calling Hitler, citing Jewish heritage. I mean, that whole, it's so wickedly weird and wild and yet in a certain way predictable to people who know history that I can't help but notice that if the shoe were on the other foot or the circumstance reversed, your country or my country might have figured out their own way to utilize those some of those 19 stereotypical war aims.
Well, I mean, I've got no doubt that the West is practicing propaganda. I mean, clearly.
Oh, everybody does. I mean, we just have to accept
that.
And
in a way, because ours is less obvious, it's probably more effective.
Tom, let me throw another angle at you. There are those who would suggest that if we were not, that we would somehow be ceding the field to our adversaries, right? That it's like I always tell people, if they say, do you think the U.S. is involved in this? I would suggest that if they weren't, you would consider it somehow a dereliction of duty, right? That the reason that these agencies often exist is, and they wouldn't say they were there to change the scene. They would say that they were there to play defense against what the other side
was doing. Well, I think they did on this occasion. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that, U.S. intelligence knew exactly what Putin's plans were, and they revealed it at every stage so that the whole kind of false flag narrative that Putin had obviously been preparing would be blown
out
of
water. From a historical standpoint, isn't that I mean, because we're getting some President Biden, and I'm not a fan of any president in my lifetime, but he took some flack for this, but I think it was genius to be, and you, as you guys well know, if you decide to sacrifice means and methods in an intelligence situation, I mean, it must be worth it. And to be able to say, it would be the equivalent of being able to tell the world that Hitler was dressing Wehrmacht soldiers in Polish uniforms to have them fight. I mean, it's brilliant if you think about it. It's almost like announcing their chess move before they make it.
Exactly. I thought it was, and I can't think actually of many examples in history.
I can't either. Well,
when
first
it's
of
ever
all,
been
both,
done.
It's going to go down in the annals of military history as something worth noting anyway.
We've got two more. Only two more.
We'll get to 5 hours, guys. You'll get to 5.5 hours on this.
I know. You're just getting in. You're just into your swing.
I'm finally warmed up.
But
exactly.
Hold on. But in your podcast, you're just talking to yourself.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of good counterpoints there.
No, I disagree with myself. I'm wrong.
Tom, right. I think you could do 5 hours on your own, Tom.
No, I couldn't. I need you, Dominic.
You're so kind.
The grit that produces the pearl.
I love that.
Okay. This is a crucial question. Dan, you need to choose bodyguards. Who would you choose to serve as your bodyguards? A, Spartans, B, Vikings, or C, samurai? So Spartans, Vikings, or samurai?
They all have something to offer, but in this case, I'm going to go with samurai. I think that just from a loyalty standpoint, I think I would trust them more. Although that, you know, I mean, I'm sure some Japanese history person is going to say, well, that would be a dumb move because of blah, blah, blah. but I certainly think that Vikings and Spartans would have probably more of an ability to, I don't know. I think samurai would be the way I would go. Short answer.
And that's a good answer. I was tempted by Vikings, Tom, because, of course, there's that huge business about oaths with Vikings. But then if you read the sagas,
yes,
they're full of people staying overnight at somebody's house who lops off their head. And
yeah, I think Vikings would be a terrible, terrible choice.
I think that's yeah.
I mean, what if they're berserkers and they'll just, you know, start taking their clothes off? I mean, you wouldn't want that, would you? It would be very embarrassing.
Depends on the social occasion.
You know, you're going out to a restaurant and suddenly your bodyguards are...
What's Spartans?
Chewing the table and stuff.
What are Spartans? Why are you not choosing Spartans?
Well, I think Spartans would be very, very good, but you'd have to ask their motivation, because Spartans are motivated by the collective, the idea of the collective. Would they be as committed to looking after you as a private individual?
Well, and if you give them a reason to argue, if you give them a reason to make those distinctions, you're already probably farther along in terms of worry as a leader about your bodyguard than you might be with the samurai, who might not get to that level of questioning, you know?
I think the samurai every time, because, Dan, as you say, I mean, their whole ethos is of loyalty.
Well, I'm sure there's some examples where that would work against you, but,
yeah,
but I
course,
think less,
of course,
yes.
Of course, but you are the kind of enlightened person who's going for germ theory. So, you know, if they fall sick, you can look after them, and they'll absolutely
love
you.
There you go. And I want to say that not choosing Vikings as a fan of Alfred the Great, there might be a little bit of prejudice involved in that decision also.
That's
let's
fine.
Acknowledge well, let's acknowledge your bias.
But also, we all have prejudice.
Am I not right in thinking the Vikings are the only people in that multiple choice sort of
who actually were bodyguards,
who were hired bodyguards for a foreign power, which is to
Varangians.
Say they were, yeah, yes. Right. Yes. So that's Harald Hardrada, friend of the show, was a. Yes. Yes. He was a very successful bodyguard, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, but they would just go around graffitiing your house.
They did leave graffiti, didn't they?
Yes, you wouldn't want that.
Well,
I think you could rely on the samurai not to do that. The samurai would beautiful,
Tom,
beautiful
you,
writing.
Of all
things.
People are not telling me that you would reject Viking graffiti in your house.
Yeah, some runes on the side of your house. Come
I would
on.
Quite like that. I would.
Yeah, I would. That. We
do
all
you know,
would.
I would actually go for Spartans just because I'd love the idea of having Spartans. But if I wanted to stay alive, I'd probably go for samurai.
Okay.
Anyway, right. Important. Those are 9 of the 10 questions.
These are the really big questions. Yeah,
we have one last
question.
Big
so this is,
historical question.
So this is the question that destroys our podcast. If you, isn't it, Tom? If Dan answers it wrong, we have to hang up our boots.
All right.
No. Well, no. I don't.
No
think
pressure.
So, actually, I don't think so.
Well, let's see. And I'd be interested to actually know whether Tom thinks about this as well. So, Dan, can we ever really know what happened in the past?
Oh, there was a great quote in Pierre Briant's book on the Persians. He quoted somebody else, and I don't remember who it was, but the great line was, even if it's not true, you have to believe ancient history. And I love that line because it so summed up to me the problem, right? I mean, the choice is to not believe any of it, in which case you're blind, or believe it and recognize that there's all kinds of stuff that you can't get your mind around in terms of truth. I would say... Rephrase the question so I answer it properly. It's not a yes or no answer, is it? Because I'm going to say that the earlier you go, the harder it is to answer that question. And conversely, the more recent you go, it's also very hard to answer that question. I think it's easier for us to know about the late 1800s, early to mid 1900s, maybe not even mid, than it is to know either Pierre Briand's Persian era or our current era right this minute, for obvious reasons. So yeah, I'm going to say yes, you know more than you don't. I mean, if you didn't know any of the stuff about the ancient Greeks because you threw it out because there was a whole bunch of nonsense mixed in, you'd be the poorer for it, I would think.
Essentially, every book I've written has been about this question, because I write about periods where the evidence is often very, very often what we call the primary sources are often crafted as literature.
Yeah, they've
so
got
Herodotus,
formula,
Herodotus, or Livy,
Suetonius,
or Tacitus.
My God,
or
he's a gossip colonist.
Yeah. So my feeling is that the way that the past is mediated to us, understanding that is understanding the past. We can know, for instance, that the Romans saw the world in a certain way that is not our way, and that the way that historians or inscriptions or whatever is preserved, they may not tell us absolutely pure objective facts that we can nail down and say, yes, this definitely happened. But what they do tell us is that this is the expression of a particular way of seeing and understanding the world. And I think we can get a handle on that.
But for example, okay, that's fine. That's understanding.
Which is also, Dominic, why I moved on to Christianity and Islam. Because I came to realize that our way of seeing the world is not neutral, and that it's kind of bred of particular traditions and inheritance of tradition, just as much as Tacitus or Herodotus had.
Yeah. Tom, what if you had Carthaginian sources to pit against the Roman ones?
Well, then our understanding of what happened in the past would become richer.
But also maybe less stable.
We can understand what happened in the Punic Wars to the degree that we can understand how the Romans saw it. When we try and work out how the Carthaginians understood what they were living through, we're looking through a glass darkly. And we're looking through the glass darkly because of the result of that war. So that is a part of the truth of the war. The fact that we don't know what the Carthaginians thought by and large is a part of the reality that we're studying, if that makes sense.
But let's take a character that you two have both, you know, you're both very interested in. You've both, in your case, Dan talked a lot about and Tom written about Julius Caesar. So much of what we know about Julius Caesar is based on a handful of sources. And those stories are repeated.
Some of those sources are Caesar himself, too.
No, I would say that relative to other great figures, I mean, certainly Alexander, but
You're talking about four sources.
Exactly. But the actually, we know quite a lot about Caesar.
But Tom, not by the standards of any modern figure.
Yeah, but we have his writings. We have writings about him in actually voluminous amounts from Cicero, which is very, very unusual. We have biographies. We actually have quite a lot of material, and we have enough, I think, to get a sense of his character, his personality, what he was about. We don't know, you know, some fairly fundamental things about his life. That's absolutely true. But I think we know enough about him to arrive at an approximation of what he was doing, partly not just because we have facts about Caesar personally, but because we have the period of Roman history in which he lived is the most richly documented in the whole of ancient history, and therefore we can situate him in a context that makes sense of the kind of person that he was.
What about a later figure then, like Caligula or Nero, who we've also talked about in this podcast?
Caligula, I think, is very difficult.
I mean, everything that we all know about Caligula, all the stories, picks up the seashells on the beach, the consul, his horse, all that stuff.
I do not know what happened, what that was about. I've read every theory there is, and none of them make sense. So I just don't know what that whole, you know, clearly getting his soldiers to pick up shells.
But let's add another aspect to this that we should all be aware of. I mean, Alexander the Great famously went around with what we would call today a paid for personal press corps. Right. So these are people who are taking an active interest in trying to manipulate how future generations will view them. And the funny thing is, when you're so bereft of sources that you only oftentimes have those kinds of sources, or sources that may be polluted by those kinds of things, it makes it even harder. It's just like, you know, trying to figure out Augustus Caesar's situation when you know darn well that if somebody during his lifetime wrote something nasty, they might not be around the next day. So it's difficult, obviously, it's part of the job, isn't it, to tease all that stuff out if you can.
Yeah,
absolutely. But I think the fact that Alexander was the kind of person who did employ people to follow around writing him up is a part of what we know.
Yes, good point.
So, and we know that his particular understanding of fame and undying glory, for instance, is influenced by Homer and the model of Achilles. So we know that as well. So there are, in a sense, what we can know, I suppose, is how treacherous the standards of objectivity in vast stretches of history are, but that in a sense you have to surrender to accepting that what we're studying is never going to be objective in the way that a 21st century historian would want it to be. And I think it can't be, because they are situated in entirely different contexts. They have entirely different understandings of who they are, what they're about, what the very nature of history is. You know, but large numbers of, as you'll know from reading Briand, the Persians didn't have an understanding of history in that way. So, which is why you have the disbalance between, say, you know, what the Persian Wars, we only have records from the Greeks, or Alexander, we only have records from the Macedonian side.
Sounds like what you're saying is, even if it's not true, you have to believe ancient history.
Well that's it.
Well, but what is truth? What is truth, I guess?
Yeah. What is truth? But also, I mean, what actually Dan is putting his finger on, Tom, is that in a previous podcast, you identified yourself, didn't you, as a cakeist, rather like Boris Johnson. So you believe in having your cake and eating it.
I didn't know what a cakeist was. I was feeling like an idiot. I'm going, what's a cakeist?
No, so a cakeist is somebody who says, well, the sources are very dodgy. Depend very much on literary formulas. However, I will now spend the next 10 pages telling you this fantastic story.
Yes, but I just
wait, that's how I start every podcast, just so you know.
So I would say that by and large, if I'm writing about people who believe in angels, I will include angels within the narrative. But I will make it clear that I don't necessarily believe in angels.
I remember once when
the belief in angels is an important part of the world in which these characters live in.
I remember once when I was an undergraduate doing Byzantine history and talking to my tutor, and we were talking about this icon that had won a siege or something. It had been the crucial factor in this siege. The icon had used its power and the attackers had been driven away. And it sort of became obvious in the course of the tutorial that we were talking slightly at cross purposes, because I was talking as if the icon was obviously a fiction and this hadn't happened. And he said, well, how do you know it didn't happen? I mean, the sources say the icon, you know, do you know better?
And I said, exactly.
Well, that's exactly. That's the difficulty with writing about. It's like our old friend Ptolemy and his talking snakes in the desert, Tom, when they're lost on the way to the Oracle of Siwa. And Arrian says, the talking snakes showed Alexander the way. And Ptolemy, I got this story from Ptolemy, and he's a king and he wouldn't lie.
But Dominic, I think it also plays back to something we were talking earlier about how do you frame George Washington or Churchill. In a sense, you have to place them in the context in which they live. That is kind of the reality. That's part of the reality. That's part of the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's not what a lot of historians do, though, is it? Because a lot of historians' instinct is to take people sort of out of the mock heroic context that they might have thought themselves in. Churchill is a good example, and to subject them to the sort of bright forensic lights of modernity, don't you think?
Yes, but I remember when I wrote a book about the origins of Islam, and it became rapidly became clear to me that the stories told by Muslims about the life of Muhammad and the origins of the Quran and so on were not to be trusted as records of what I would recognize as fact. And yet they created their own reality. And that reality,
I was just going to say that, yes.
You know, it has changed the world.
Yes.
And I remember also talking about this and a Muslim in the audience saying, well, you know, on what basis are you saying it's not true? Because, you know, it's not like you're being neutral. Your perspective is just as, you know, you don't believe in God. You don't believe in the God that I believe in. But but your disbelief is just as much a biased position as my belief in God. And I've always remembered that.
I think that's fascinating, by the way. Absolutely. And I think your line, I was just thinking it too, that if enough people believe it for long enough, it creates its own reality as if it doesn't matter so much whether it actually happened or not, because that didn't influence all the people that were 100% sure it did happen and acted on that basis.
I can't actually remember what Dan's answer was now. It seems so long ago. Your answer was yes. You do think... Was that your answer? Yes, we can.
Yes, yes, yeah, yes, yes, yes. I think so. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Well, that's a relief because we can continue our history podcast.
No, otherwise we'd have to cancel it.
I asked science historian James Burke that same question, and he answered yes. Also,
excellent. Oh,
well, he must be right then.
Yeah, that's what I was.
He was right on everything.
That's what I was asserting. Yes.
Wonderful. So, Dan, we haven't quite made 5 hours. But we have gone on an
That's
hour
not
longer
my
than...
fault, Dominic. That's not my fault.
We have gone on exactly an hour longer than we were expecting to, which is a sign, I think, of a good conversation.
I hope so.
So thank you so much for coming on The Rest Is History. It's great to... We have had other podcasters on from time to time, Tom, but I don't think we've ever had people with the... who've gone past the 5 hour mark on their own podcast. So,
never.
So you guys, this was actually a great honor, and I'm a big fan. So thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And Tom,
the honor is all ours.
Tom restrained himself from doing his American accent, which is, I mean, if he did it with you, you'd
run screaming out. Into
you would have
night.
Done, yeah. So
I'm not.
We can all play that game. So you guys are just as fortunate. I didn't do one of my British accents. So.
All right. Brilliant. Well, thank you all for listening. And thank you again to Dan Carlin from Hardcore History for coming on the show. And we'll see you all next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to The Rest Is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest Is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest Is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.